Me too. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the regular meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Lahontan Region. Already too anxious this morning. My name is Pete Pumphrey. I'm from Chalfont, and I am the chair. I want to thank the members of the public for coming to our meeting. We do a better job when you participate in the issues that come before us. At this time, I would like to introduce the other members of the regional board. Kimberly Cox from Hellendale, Keith Diaz from Rosamond, Dr. Amy Horn from Truckee, Don Jardine from Markleyville, Eric Sandell from Truckee. The executive officer is Patty Kuyumjin. You want to introduce them? I guess they all know each other.
Good morning. Patty Kuyumjin. Did I introduce some of the staff that are joining us today? I'll start with those who traveled from Sacramento. Chris Garrigan from the State Board Office Enforcement is joining us. Thank you. And Gita Kapai in the back, also from the State Board. We have Kim Niemeyer, our staff counsel, walking to replace there. And Sue Gennaro, the board's clerk. Mike Plasiak is here, who's our division manager in the Victor Borough office, as is Doug Smith. And I apologize, Lori. Pastor Lori, our assistant executive officer, right there in the front row. Jay Cass is here from our Victor Borough office. And Cindy Mitten. And Patrice Copeland. Scott Ferguson is here as well. We'll be hearing from him in a few minutes. And Doug Taxer from our Tahoe office. I think I've got everybody. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Did you mention Chris Kerrigan?
Yes.
Okay.
The regional board will be considering many items during the meeting. Although we must use our time wisely, we encourage your input on any item, so our discussion will be based on all available information. If you wish to speak on any agenda item, please fill out an orange card indicating which item you wish to address and how many minutes you will need. Although we do not administer an oath in most proceedings before the board, we expect all statements made before the board to be truthful, with no attempts to mislead by false statement, deceptive presentation, or failure to include essential information. We also ask that you obey our ground rules, which are: treat everyone with respect. This includes board members, board staff, anyone who testifies, and your fellow citizens. This means no personal attacks and no violent, contemptuous, or disruptive behavior. In the interest of everyone's time, please communicate your ideas clearly and efficiently. So that we can develop an accurate administrative record, we ask that you speak only after you are recognized. At that time, please come to the lectern and speak to the agenda item. If you do not follow these rules or become repetitious, I may ask you to sit down. Any person aggrieved by an action or inaction of the regional board, including but not limited to the issuance, modification, or rejection of waste discharge requirements, administrative civil liability, or a cease and desist order, may petition the State Board Water Resources Control Board to review the decision. The State Board must receive the petition within 30 days of the Regional Board's meeting at which the action was taken. Board staff will provide you with copies of the regulations about filing petitions if you request them. They are also available on the State Water Resources Control Board's website. It's my understanding that there is a member of the public who wishes to speak to the board this morning, so I thought perhaps we could begin with that. Yes, sir.
Good morning. My name is Lester White. I'm a Hinckley community member, and I wanted to speak to you guys last night. I didn't feel it was appropriate to do it last night, and I just wanted to give you guys a short, brief talk about what it is that the direction I'm going in. And I've created about 2 years ago, created a nonprofit organization. It's called Hinckley Partnership for Healthy Living. And I went ahead and went through the whole process of it. And I've been working with the Mojave Water Agency, and we're creating an integrated water plan. And it's very exciting to get a water pipeline in our community. And I have been working tirelessly on it. So, and I started with the TAC meetings at the Mahoney Water Agency. And I just wanted to let you guys know that I appreciate all the time and effort that you guys have helped us with, and we're just going to keep moving forward with the project. And there's a lot of little components to all of this, so I'm going to do the best I can and move in the right direction. And the right direction is bringing healthy water to our community. And I sit in the meeting last night, and I wanted to speak a whole bunch of times, but I just kind of bit my tongue and figured that things are going to go the way they're going to go, and you guys know what you're doing, so... I just want to let you know that in January, we're going to do our best to the Mahoney Water Agency to bring a presentation to you, because right now everything's just conceptual. So we've got the designs, the engineers are working on designs to implement this idea, and we're working on grants and funding, and having a meeting today. We're going to work on grants and just keep moving forward with the project, and we'll definitely keep you informed of everything that's going on, and I want to have a public meeting. I'm going to try my best to have one in December and get community support, of course, and I've got lots of that already, and so just want to let you guys know what's happening, and that's all I had to say. And if you have any questions for me, I'll be happy to answer any.
Any questions from board members? Mr. Sandell?
No, none.
Mr. Dyett?
I don't have a question, just a comment.
Yes.
Mr. White, I commend you on your work. And I think you're headed in the right direction. I haven't seen your design, but it sounds to me like it might be a long-term solution. Good luck to you.
Yes. And also we have someone here from Tim Gobbler from Mojave Water Agency, and he'd like to speak in a little bit. I don't know if he wants to do it right now, next, or whatever you guys have planned. But that's it. And
Dr. Horn?
I second Mr. Dias's comments.
Mr. Jardine?
I third that.
Ms. Cox.
Are you working with Rural Water at all?
Not yet.
A tremendous resource.
Yes.
Yeah, so. I would encourage you to get hooked up with them. They're very, very supportive of our unincorporated areas.
All right.
And Lester Mike is working on that as well, and we'll coordinate with you on technical assistance on that piece that you just mentioned. So.
I'm excited about working with Mike. I like Mike, so. I like everybody. I'm happy now. Our community is very happy, so just want to let you guys know that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to speak to the board? Okay. I'd like to move to item 8 on the agenda, which is a discussion of the Water Board Enforcement Program.
Good morning, members of the board. My name is Scott Ferguson, and I'm a senior water resource control engineer, and I'm also the supervisor of your enforcement and special projects unit. This morning, we're going to be talking about agenda item number 8, and it's an update on the board's enforcement program. And this is an informational item only, so we're not asking you for any formal decision or action following the presentations. But we will be asking for some feedback as we move through our presentations. And there's several elements to this item, and after each item, we'll have a little Q&A session, and if the board wants to provide some direction, that would be the appropriate time on that specific element.
Okay.
This morning, we're going to be looking at, looks like, four different elements. I'm going to first start with an overview of the quarterly violations report for the second quarter of 2013. And then we'll move into a discussion of our enforcement program and some of the work that we've been doing during the past 3 months. This will be the third time that I've come before you to talk about the enforcement program. We first met in March of 2013, again in June of 2013, and here we are again. With this update, Water Board staff and State Board staff have been working with two Water Board subcommittees, the first one being the Enforcement Subcommittee with Board members Pumphrey and Sandell, and then the second subcommittee is the SEP, or the Supplemental Environmental Project Subcommittee, with board members Horn and Pumphrey. And with this update, we're going to be, we have some good progress to report on. I'll be talking about hearing procedures template, and the real important part is the public participation fact sheet that we've developed. We'll also be looking at a new tool that staff's going to be starting to use here pretty soon. That will help us with consistency in our response to various situations that we encounter on a regular basis. And then finally, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Eric Taxer, who's on your staff, and Lisa Wallace, who's the Executive Director of the Truckee River Watershed Council. And they're going to be discussing some of the work that they've been working on with the SEP subcommittee to develop a proposal that we believe will make our SEP program much more efficient if you choose to move forward with it. And I'm hoping that you find it as interesting and as exciting as I do. So your agenda packages contain a quarterly violations report for the second quarter of 2013. And it also includes a cover memorandum. This is enclosure number 5 of agenda item 8. And I just want to go over, provide a little overview of that and highlight a couple things that aren't actually covered by that. So on a big picture, we had 165 violations entered into our databases for the period of April 1st through June 30th. Almost two-thirds of those, or 105 of those, were linked to a single facility, Oak Tree Inn. And I'll discuss Oak Tree Inn in just a moment. Also, in reviewing the report, we addressed our priority one violations, our most serious violations, with a combination of informal and formal enforcement. And we used only informal enforcement at this point to address our priority two and our priority three violations. And I think this is in part reflection upon some of the communication that's happened between us during our enforcement program discussions and that we've put into practice, which is the idea that we're trying to address these violations and return the discharger to compliance with the lowest level that effectively accomplishes that task, the lowest level of enforcement. So we also use a number of different factors in determining what enforcement actions to take, and those include impacts to beneficial uses, threats to potential receptors, the discharger's responsiveness to the situation, the time period required to address the violation or the causes of those violations or the impacts of those violations. And I think our new tool that I mentioned on helping us with consistency and response actually encompasses all this into a single document that will make it more useful and effective for staff putting this into practice. So the cover memo identifies a number of facilities, and this is something we started last June by including a new column in our quarterly violations report, which identifies the number of violations that the facilities that have current violations had in the previous 12 months. So it gives you a little context. Is this a one-time violation, or is this kind of a part of a series of violations? And as I mentioned earlier, Oak Tree Inn had almost two-thirds of the violations in this report. And this is part of a continuing series of violations. They are related to their flow limit that's specified in their waste discharge requirement, and they are discharging more wastewater to the groundwater than is allowed in their permit. So that's the violation. And they've had almost daily violations for the past 14 months. Now, this hasn't gone unnoticed. We have initiated two notices of violation. And based on the information that we've received, we're starting to look at maybe taking a little different tack than continued enforcement in this. The discharger believes that their facility actually has greater capacity than allowed in the permit. And to some extent, this is backed up in that we're not seeing any effluent quality violations show up, just the flow limits being violated. But on the other hand, we are starting to see data that indicates we're seeing water quality degradation in the groundwater with respect to nitrates. That's of great concern. So what we're looking at is there is the possibility that we may be able to revise the permit, increase the capacity limit. However, before we do that, we need some more information. So within the past week or so, our Victorville staff issued a letter that started that process to have the discharger better evaluate the capabilities of his facility, treatment facility, with respect to a multiple water quality constituents or pollutants, including nitrogen. And then once they have a better understanding of just what that facility can do, then evaluate what will be the impact at higher levels if we were to increase the flow limit to what they're proposing on the groundwater or the receiving water, and basically do an anti-degradation analysis. Once we have that information, then we'll be in a position to where we can make a decision of whether or not it is appropriate to propose to you increasing their flow limitation in a set of revised waste discharge requirements. So this is a little different animal than you're typically seeing me explain, because I'm usually up here violations, enforcement. Well, we've done violations, some enforcement. We may be taking the regulatory route on this, but we need more information. So this one's a little more interesting than some of the others. But the next one I want to talk about is Barstow Wastewater Treatment Facility. They have continuously been on your violations report for groundwater nitrate pollution due to past disposal practices. They're going to continue to show up on this report because it takes time to take care of groundwater pollution. The good news is the executive officer signed a cleanup and abatement order earlier this summer that established the time schedule for implementing the city's proposed cleanup plan. And that's going to be an extraction system, treatment system, disposal. And so now we have a time schedule. During the next year, they will be putting the infrastructure in, getting things set up, and I anticipate that within about in about a year from now, they will put that system into operation and start to treat the groundwater for nitrate. And in the meantime, the affected residents who are on individual wells are being supplied replacement water for their protection of their health and safety. Molycorp, another one that shows up on our violations report on a fairly routine basis. We saw that there was a series of those violations, and as I've explained to you before, we issued a comprehensive notice of violation earlier this year. I'm happy to report that since that has been issued, and it was directing them to look at their operation and maintenance program, because that's where we saw the core cause of many of their violations, that they have seen a significant reduction in violations. So in 2012, they had roughly about 25 spills. This year, they've had roughly about 6. So we're making good progress. We will continue to monitor it to make sure that this turnaround is maintained. Caltrans. Caltrans has been busy working up in South Lake Tahoe on Highway 50. And this has been a project that has had quite a few BMP-related violations, and I think through the strong effort on board staff's part, we've avoided discharge-related violations on this project. Looking back on this one, looking forward, we are considering and evaluating the potential for additional enforcement, even though this project is now in its third and final year, wrapping up. Looking backwards, I think this would have been a prime candidate early on to apply our fix-it ticket ACL idea. And we are working over the next few months so that that will be in place and available for our use with the upcoming construction season. And then finally, we discussed in the cover memo with the violations report, Levitt Lake CSD wastewater treatment plant or facility. And this is a small wastewater district up in Lassen County, east of Susanville, about a little over 200 customers, and they've experienced a number of effluent quality related violations over the years, and it really comes down to, I think, the combination of infrastructure and maintenance, and both have been lacking over the years. We used an investigative order to kind of help them evaluate what were the causes of these violations, what's the plan to take care of it. Now, they have extremely limited resources, but they did put a plan together, and they have started implementing that plan. We have been working with them since the investigative order on an informal basis, but they have been moving forward. They're bringing a permanent power supply out to the site. They've been cleaning up some of the ponds, and we're hopeful that this will get them into compliance. They're seeking additional funding, and we're hoping that that will help. Once they obtain that, that will help them maintain compliance. Now, as I said earlier, I'm usually up here talking violations and enforcement, difficult situations. I like to talk about something positive. And that's what this slide identifies. N&M Dairy has been a case that we've been working on for quite some time. And as was reported to you yesterday, the advisory team has received a proposed settlement agreement and a proposed cleanup and abatement order. And that's positive. That's good progress. The proposed orders have already gone through the public review comment period, which closed this past Friday, and the advisory team is currently reviewing those comments. Proposed settlement agreement consists of a combination of cash liability payment and of a supplemental environmental project. And the proposed cleanup order continues to require that replacement water be provided, and it also revises and consolidates a number of different monitoring requirements spread out across multiple orders. The dischargers currently are under a cleanup and abatement order requiring them to provide replacement water. And so the downstream or gradient residents are protected. They're having drinking water provided. This order will revise a couple of the requirements associated with that program and, like I said, the monitoring. And that's why it's being proposed. While these documents have been put together, the dairy has been closed. The owners have closed it. They have removed all cows, so there's no more manure being produced. Much of the dairy infrastructure has been and is being removed, and waste cleanup at the site is underway. Also, the odor and nuisance conditions associated with odors and flies have disappeared. We have not gotten any complaints for quite a while now, which is also significant progress out there. So that's something that's good news. Aramol Group, this was a discharger that was brought before you back in January. You issued an ACL order for $60,000 for the destruction, unauthorized destruction and damage to surface waters up in the Lake Arrowhead area. Glad to report that since that action has been taken, the working relationship with the discharger and his new consultants has been much more cooperative and productive. Also, I'm glad to report that just recently, a second cleanup and abatement order that will result in the restoration of those surface waters was issued. And even prior to that, the discharger's consultants were working with Water Board staff to develop the plans necessary to identify where those surface waters were before they were destroyed or damaged, what were their characteristics and the locations. And I am anticipating, they've submitted a number of reports. We've given quick review. We're coordinating with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I'm anticipating that restoration activities will actually get underway within the next week or so, and that they will be completed early to mid-November of this year. So that's positive progress there, too. And then the last one I want to highlight is Atalanta Wastewater Treatment Plant. This one was brought before you a number of times, taking up considerable time and staff effort and board effort and the discharger's efforts. And those efforts have all been paying off. Glad to report their wastewater treatment plant expansion project is complete. They now have adequate treatment and disposal capacity to handle everything that the Atalanta service area produces. They are no longer discharging or diverting wastewater flows to VVWRA, and so they are back on track. We've already started drafting up some rescission orders for the various enforcement actions that have been issued, and I anticipate you'll be seeing those in early 2014 for your consideration. So that's good positive news. Let's see. So that's the quarterly violations report element of my presentation. Are there any questions? Yes.
How long will it take? How long is the project for the Barstow CAO? What's the implementation length on that?
They are to have it operational, I believe, by November of 2014. That's when it'll be put turned on, basically.
Mm-hmm. And then,
I don't, to be honest with you, I don't know how long it will take. As part of that cleanup abatement order, they will be doing more intensive monitoring to see how effective it is and if it's achieving its goals and how long it will take. That's part of not knowing what's going on completely underground, what we can't see.
And then I just want to make a comment that I'm sorry Board Member Jack Clark isn't here to hear about the Atalanta progress.
Yes. Any other questions or comments on this element? Okay. Let's keep moving. So now let's talk about the enforcement program. So I was here before you last time in June. And at that meeting, the board discussed and highlighted 7 enforcement program elements, focused a little more attention on them, and they're listed out on this slide. During the past 3 months, we've been putting some effort into the 3 that are listed there: the hearing procedures template, consistency and response, and our supplemental environmental project program. And what I want to talk about first is I will be discussing the first 2 elements, and then I'll turn it over to Eric and Lisa to discuss the 3rd. So let's look at our hearing procedures template. Just as a brief reminder, our hearing procedures are really what identify the roles and responsibilities of the various parties that are involved with public hearings that come before you with enforcement actions. They also provide guidance on submittals of technical, legal arguments, evidence, comments from the Water Board's prosecution team, the responsible parties, and also other interested parties, which includes the public. And then the final thing they do is they actually identify how the public hearing itself is going to be managed. And what gets lost in all this is where's the public's role in this? I mean, our hearing procedures are about 9 pages long, and I think you get to page 2 or 3 before you see the public. And so what we have done is we have developed a public participation fact sheet that would be going out with the hearing procedures when we start going down that pathway. And then they clearly identify what the process is, what the roles of the public are, what their responsibilities are, and when they get to participate and how they can participate. And I think this is a significant improvement in our overall process, setting up our hearing procedures and stuff. So that's exciting news. We need to do a little more work on those, and then I think they'll be ready for consideration at a January board meeting for formal adoption. The other thing is our hearing procedures template, and this is enclosure number 2 in your package. It's nearly complete, and what is provided in your package is actually based on what went out for hearing procedures for the upcoming Spalding Tract cease and desist order public hearing scheduled for your November board meeting. We need to simply make them a little more generic and address a couple administrative issues regarding who and how and when the public or the procedures are released leading up to a public hearing. I anticipate that we will be able to bring these back before you for your consideration and formal adoption, and that was something the board members had expressed an interest in, is formally adopting a hearing template, and I would say we put the public participation fact sheet with that. And then once they're adopted, we will be posting them on our website and using them routinely, hopefully not often though. So that takes us through this element. Does anybody have any questions or comments or see any opportunities for significant improvement on either of these documents?
Well, Dr. Horn.
Okay, sorry. first of all, this is really exciting, and I think the other subcommittee that was working on this has done some great work on this, so I'm very encouraged by the progress I'm hearing. I would just offer, if you're interested, when you get the public participation sheet and the hearing procedures down to where you think they're done, if you wanted to send them to me for one final edit, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. We'll take you up on that offer.
Anything else from any board member?
No, I'd much rather Amy did that than I. So. Excellent. I was heading that way. Great.
Well, we will continue to make progress, and we'll see you in January for that one. The last element I'm going to discuss is a table that's provided in enclosure number 3 of your agenda package. And this table was created out of a board request for a document that summarizes how do we typically respond, what's our typical response to a number of different situations that we face as board staff on a fairly routine basis. And what's the basis for those responses? And who's involved with that decision-making process of when you do this for that and all this? I've compiled this table, and I think it accomplishes providing that information. In the first column, it does provide a whole number of different incident types that staff routinely encounters. And they're in varying degrees of severity. And recognizing, sometimes people correct things right away, some things continue, and they require different actions. Then you have the recommended initial response for staff. And then following that in the third column is who is involved with the decision-making process, who's consulted in making those decisions. Then on the second page, you start to see footnotes, which identify suites of potential follow-up actions. And in parentheses, they identify for what types of purpose you would use these follow-up actions. So an example would be unauthorized discharge of fill to the waters of the U.S., let's just say, which is one of the generics. So this is like an air mall situation. So we did issue NOBs, which I believe is probably the first response. And then we started looking and implementing the suite. We issued a cleanup and abatement order. And because we realized we had a long-term restoration project ahead of us. And then we pursued the ACL pathway for the penalty element of it. So that's how I see this playing out. And the real benefit I see here is I think we will see an improvement. Not that our consistency in response is all that bad. I think we're pretty good already. We're going to see improvement, though. Staff will have something right there that they can go to and look rather than kind of scratch their head sometimes, as I do, and go, what did we do last time? So right there, we'll have it ready. I think it will also help with the communication, understanding who needs to be consulted, and that will help develop consistency in response also. And also, there's an explanation of how do we use these tools in the various scenarios. And so a better understanding of when do you apply what kind of tool in what type of situation, both for initial response and follow-up response. The next steps on this item will be some internal discussions among staff. I'm looking to present this to senior and staff and management. And I think most of the responses you see are probably going to remain unchanged. I suspect some of them will change after those discussions. Once we finalized it, I'm going to release it to all of staff, provide a little training on how to use it, what it's for, why we're doing this, and what the benefits of it are. And then we'll routinely, periodically review it, say like annually, see how it's working for us, see if we need to make changes, and we'll revise it as necessary. So that's my last element. Are there any questions, comments, direction on that? This one I don't plan on bringing back before you again.
Yes.
I think it's a great great chart. I did have one question. I can't find it defined anywhere. What are staff group 1, 2, and 3?
If you look on the first page, on the first row, under staff involvement, it identifies the specific parties that are involved, and then in parentheses, it says staff group 1, and I follow that process. Once I've identified the main group, then in that manner, I continue to use it. Any other questions, comments?
Mr. Jardine?
No.
Mr. Sandell?
No, this is good.
No, thank you.
Dr. Horn?
Of course. What's the significance of the rows that are in blue?
Oh, basically they're different, just separating violation type groups, incident type groups. So the first one, the first two that are highlighted in blue, they're self-monitoring reports related. The next ones are all sanitary.
Oh, I see.
So it's just grouping.
I see. Okay. And then I'm sort of intrigued with the idea of some portion of this being posted on the website in the interest of transparency. I think sometimes our dischargers kind of go, where did this come from? There's pros and cons to this, but it would be interesting to discuss this as a group. So we don't want to make people understanding that, you know, sort of incorporating polluting as a cost of business.
Right.
But on the other hand, to put them on notice that if they do certain things, these are the consequences. So some balance there might be something to think about.
I think the way we've already come up with a way to address that, hey, if there are additional consequences if you don't take care of business now. And we've discussed that as both at the subcommittee level and as this group together. And the message I took away from those discussions is that it is imperative that in all of our enforcement actions, we have a section that clearly outlines what happens, what can happen if you don't take care of business, if you don't return to compliance as soon as possible. I think that helps address that there are potential consequences, and it helps outline what is a potential pathway from here on out.
Yeah. I guess I'm thinking of communication that is, instead of being one-to-one, is one-to-many. So, you know, if there are efficiencies involved in some component of this information being on the website so that, you know, people who haven't come to the attention of the enforcement team yet can stay that way.
Mm-hmm. So, what I would recommend at this point is that maybe we get together as the subcommittee again and discuss this.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a very good idea to further the notion of general deterrence.
Right.
And not necessarily deterrence, but incentivizing compliance. You know, deterrence sort of has a two-edged sword. I try to do this at the State Board website. Certain selected items really send a good message.
So that's my. Are.
And I'm Chris Kerrigan, the director of the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement.
I agree with Scott that maybe this should be something that we discuss in the subcommittee, and because I think there are pros and cons to doing it, and
right.
we should explore that a little bit more.
Well, I would agree with that, because the drawback that I see to publishing this on the website. One is that it conveys the notion that everybody's entitled to all of these preliminary steps, even if they blow up the dam or whatever. The other thing, my experience is, as soon as you prepare one of these charts, about 3 weeks later something happens that wasn't anticipated, and you're not going to be able to follow the chart. And if this is a public document, it suggests that people are entitled to this no matter the significance of their conduct. What I would suggest maybe we talk about, though, is a summary of this that says, here are the ways that things can be dealt with, and without this much detail. So I think that's a good idea to refer that back to the subcommittee.
Okay.
And I have, if I could interrupt your presentation.
Yes, you may.
And so that we could take a short break.
Oh. This would be actually a good time because I'm going to turn it over to.
Okay, that would be fine. My other comment is, this is hard stuff to get right, and I'm not sure that you ever really do in terms of the documents, but this is awfully, awfully close if it's not right there.
Okay. Thank you.
Did say subset of
information. Anyway, so that's the kind of stuff I like.
Yeah.
There's old fire lookouts. There's old cows up there.
Yes, sir.
Alrighty. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Eric Taxer, and I am a water resource control engineer in your Lake Tahoe office. And I'm here to provide the subcommittee's report to the Water Board. And I'd just like to thank everyone for allowing me to be involved in this process. It's really fun to be part of this discussion and not be up here in an adversarial, prosecutorial role, embracing my inner Perry Mason. It's all a new experience, so thanks. So, moving forward, and let's bring everybody up to speed on SEPs and supplemental environmental projects, you know, how they work, and what's required of them. Basically, a SEP is a portion of an ACL penalty that is suspended until a SEP is completed in its entirety, as originally agreed upon. So, if a SEP is not completed, a discharger is still on the hook for paying the full penalty amount, regardless of how much money they've already spent on completing a portion of a step. Per the State Board's Supplemental Environmental Project Policy, it lays out specific criteria that projects must follow in order to be considered eligible for a SEP. One of the items is that there must be a project that enhances the beneficial uses of the state of California, of waters of the state of California. It must be a project that provides a benefit to the public at large. It must be a project that is not otherwise required of the discharger or of other dischargers. And it must be a project that provides no fiscal benefit to the water board members or its staff. So, for example, we can't consider a project that where we can hire our relatives. That would be a fiscal benefit to us. The policy states that up to half of the negotiated penalty amount may be considered for suspension to complete a SEP. And the policy outlines a plethora of other criteria with respect to project count, project tracking, project accountability, and it provides a whole slew of example types of projects that may be considered eligible for a SEP. So the prosecution team, water board staff, have been using the SEP policy through the years when we enter into negotiations to settle various violations. And the process has been far from ideal. When a SEP is being considered, being proposed, it takes a lot of staff time to go back and forth with the discharger, ensure that it's something that may be palpable to the water board, and ensure that it's consistent with the SEP policy. From the public's perspective, it's been far from ideal because there's this impression that the SEPs are being developed under the cloak of secrecy, if you will, because they're considered, or they're being developed in confidential settlement negotiations. And there's really no clue on how we went about, from the public's perspective, there's no clue on how we went about developing the SEP. We develop it, it becomes public, but the background is not public. So there's little or no transparency in the process. So to address these issues, the Water Board established a SEP subcommittee consisting of Chairman Pumphrey and Dr. Horn, and I was fortunate to be able to participate in these discussions.
We look so much younger in there.
Yeah, I know. I thought you liked that.
And I have hair.
So, you know, we looked as fabulous as this photo, and the act as fabulous as this photo represents, which I like. But we also solicited input from our legal counsel, Kim Niemeyer, Office of Chief Counsel, and Chris Kerrigan from Office of Enforcement. And we also solicited quite a bit of input from Cindy Weisner's office. She manages applications for the State Revolving Fund, Prop 84 stuff. She's really instrumental in our relationship with the local integrated regional water management groups throughout the region. So she was a huge resource, especially for me. I'm bouncing ideas off of her and how we should proceed with some of the ideas that the committee was coming up with. So, first off the bat, the committee wanted to clarify some questions that we had with respect to how the SEP policy was being interpreted. First off, we clarified that it is the discharger who is the one who proposes a SEP. We can't force a SEP on a discharger. We can certainly, in a negotiation process, guide a discharger, you know, in one direction or the other. And we, of course, ensure that whatever they're proposing is consistent with the SEP policy. But at the end of the day, it's the discharger who has to propose the SEP. And this is important, too, because they are accepting a level of risk by entering into an agreement to perform a SEP. If the SEP doesn't get performed as agreed upon, they're still paying the money, regardless of how much money they've already paid for completing a portion of a SEP. We clarified that SEPs must be projects that are not already required of the discharger or other dischargers, but there's some gray area in this. For example, if a discharger has TMDL elements in their permit, we can consider something that goes above and beyond what those elements are. For example, if, say, El Dorado County is required to install 5 sediment basins within a 5-year period, we can consider a SEP that would allow for construction of a 6th or a 7th sedimentation basin within that 5-year period, because it goes above and beyond what's already required. We can also consider projects that are identified by the Water Board through your triennial review process or by some other prioritization process that you develop. For example, if you identify a need to conduct some specific water quality monitoring to support a basin plan update, that may be a project that could be considered eligible for SEPs, even though it does benefit the Water Board's role for protecting water quality. It doesn't benefit the Water Board in a fiscally in a fiscal manner. And with respect to Nexus, the SEP policy requires that there be some sort of a direct relationship between either the location or nature of a violation to the nature and location of a proposed SEP project. So that translates into ensuring that we either have a geographic or a programmatic nexus. We did clarify that we can expand that boundary, or we don't have to limit our focus to a sub-hydrologic unit where a violation occurs. For example, if a violation occurred, say, in Martha's Creek, which is tributary to the overall Truckee River hydrologic unit, we can consider a SEP to be in a location anywhere within the Truckee River hydrologic unit. For example, in Gray Creek, Bronco Creek, or some other stretch of the Truckee River. We don't have to limit our focus to just Martha's Creek. So, after we clarified those issues, or those questions, the committee expressed its preference that, yeah, we do like SEPs, and the committee wants the prosecution team to consider encouraging dischargers to incorporate SEPs when we enter into these settlement negotiations. And on top of that, the committee expressed some preferences that we'd like the prosecution team to consider when we enter into these negotiations. First, the committee requests that we consider projects that have some sort of a direct connectivity to a specific water body and provide a direct water quality benefit when we're looking at these projects. Basically, the committee likes on-the-ground, shovel-ready, pre-permitted projects already gone through the CEQA process. And the committee likes these projects above and beyond conducting technical studies, especially in areas, in hydrologic units, where there's already a watershed management plan in place. In that circumstance, we want to see on-the-ground types of projects. However, in hydrologic units where there isn't a watershed management plan in place, a technical study that supports the development of a watershed management plan may have a higher priority than conducting an on-the-ground project. For example, if we need to develop a salt nutrient management plan in a certain area, that would probably have a higher priority than an on-the-ground type of project. And finally, with respect to geographic nexus, the committee expressed its desire that we do go ahead, expand our focus beyond the sub-hydrologic unit. And we are also looking at expanding the geographic nexus to encompass an entire island group boundary. So, for example, island groups typically consist of various neighboring water bodies, like the Tahoe Sierra. Island group has the Truckee River, Lake Tahoe, Carson River watersheds. So in this circumstance, if a violation were to occur, say, in Lake Tahoe, and we develop a SEP, does it make sense to develop a SEP that provides a project within the Lake Tahoe hydrologic unit where Lake Tahoe receives a plethora of funding from all sorts of different sources? Or does it make more sense to look at the island group boundary and say, you know what, there's a need in the Carson River area. Alpine County doesn't have the resources, but Lake Tahoe does. Why not expand the boundary to allow for a project to be conducted within the Carson River area? So that is something that we're looking at, and it's something that is allowed by the SEP policy, depending on what the situation is. One of the fun things that came out of the committee is that there was a recommendation that we pursue establishing a series of partnerships with independent third parties to manage what we call SEP escrow accounts, or endowments, or operating accounts. So how this would work is that, you know, if the board chooses to follow this, is that we would develop agreements with various third parties throughout the region. we would develop a template, if you will, for an agreement that can be basically boilerplate for throughout the whole region, but yet we could still tailor it to meet specific geographic issues throughout the region. Once these agreements are in place with the entity, a discharger can then opt to suspend up to half their penalty to fund one of these SEP escrow accounts. Of course, they can opt to propose an entirely different SEP or to send all the money to State Board instead, and we'll never see that money again. But if they do choose to opt to send the money to State Board, I mean to the one of the SEP escrow accounts, then the third party would basically act as the bursar of those funds, and they would direct the monies towards completing SEP projects in accordance with the agreements that have been established with the Water Board. In seeking a third party, we would look for groups that are established, that have some sense of longevity to them. They're not a fly-by-night organization that have just come down the pike yesterday. They've been around for a while, and we know that they're going to continue to exist to manage these escrow accounts. We want someone who has a proven track record for successfully completing water quality projects, and someone who incorporates a stakeholder process so that we can ensure that there is some sort of local input into how that third party is proposing various SEP projects. And overall, we're looking at the various IREN groups as sort of the model of what we're going towards. Finding a third party within that's representative of each IREN group, and to establish a SEP escrow account within each IREN group area. So in addition to those partnership agreements, we would establish specific criteria on how those third parties would identify appropriate projects that may be eligible for SEPs. We want to ensure that whatever's being considered is consistent with the board's identified priorities, and we want to ensure that the projects are also consistent with the SEP policy and any other criteria that we identify. For example, the State Revolving Fund has criteria with respect to protecting human health and specific water resources. The State Strategic Plan has specific identified criteria with protecting water quality. And this is where Cindy Weiss has been really instrumental in helping us identify those criteria that we can overlay on top of these local organizations that already vet some projects for consideration. So we would also want to we want to identify within those agreements with the third parties that they provide to us an annual report of the progress of the SEPs and the progress of SEPs that have been completed. We want them to provide us with an annual report of what SEPs may be eligible for the coming fiscal year, along with the associated budget with those projects, so that we have a list at the ready of what projects we can consider and steer a discharger toward in a settlement negotiation situation. So, and then, of course, organizations that incorporate the stakeholder process. So the advantages of establishing these SEP escrow accounts are many. It gives us, the prosecution team staff, a list of projects that have already been identified, vetted, and prioritized by local stakeholders within each geographic area. And by doing that, it increases the transparency of how these projects are being developed and identified for folks throughout our region, and increases the level of local participation in the development of these proposed projects. It also integrates the Water Board's planning process with the planning process that's being conducted on the more local basis, and helps us to align our water quality management plans with each other. And by incorporating the stakeholder process, it helps us to strengthen our relationships with our local stakeholders. This also increases the flexibility in how we get to use these SEP funds. Currently, when we're negotiating a SEP, we're pretty much trying to identify a project that matches dollar for dollar the amount that the discharger is willing to suspend as part of their liability. And that really limits us in the amount, in the kinds of projects and the number of projects we can consider. But if we establish set escrow accounts, it kind of opens the door. The organizations can then take this chunk of money and they can use it to fund a single complete project, or they can use it to fund multiple projects that add up to that dollar amount. They can use it to close the gap funding in projects that are currently underway, but they just need a little bit more to get over that hurdle. They can also use it to as seed money, to leverage it, to leverage other funding sources from, say, grants or whatnot. And by doing that, we can complete a project that is much larger and much more involved than what we could have originally contemplated. And this also increases the likelihood that a discharger may want to actually consider a SEP. Again, a discharger is the one who proposes the SEP, and they are on the hook, or they're accepting a level of risk. If we have agreements in place with strong third parties who have a proven track record for completing water quality projects, it reduces that level of angst that a discharger may have for completing a SEP, and they'll hopefully feel more comfortable that if they do fund one of these SEP escrow accounts, that the project will indeed get completed per the agreements, and that they won't have to be on the hook for that entire settlement amount. This is the part I like. It reduces our efforts. You know, because again, it takes us a lot of time to go back and forth to negotiate a project. For VVWRA SEP that we did for the funding of the salt nutrient plant, it took us a long time to get to that project. There was a lot of other projects that were considered, and I'd say it took about a couple months of back and forth, project review, consulting with folks, so on and so forth. That's a lot of time, and it's so much easier just to say, here's the list, use it, done. We'll have a third party that will be maintaining that list, they're providing the project oversight, so that we don't have to do that still, they're providing us the annual status reports. Yes, it will take some staff time up front to develop these grants and to get this process in place, but I think that's time well spent in the long run. So, the committee, you know, this is a recommendation, one of the recommendations from the committee, but instead of jumping in whole hog with this process, the committee felt it would be more appropriate to just dip our toes in the water, so to speak, and to see how it goes. So the committee recommended that we look into the development of a pilot project on a small scale. In this process, they identified the Truckee River Watershed Council as an appropriate entity that we could use for a pilot project. The Watershed Council was chosen because they do have a proven track record for successfully completing water quality projects. They've been around for a long time, so there's some longevity to them. They're not going away. They're fiscally sound. They have sound accounting practices. And they have extensive stakeholder involvement. And speaking from my perspective, I've worked with Watershed Council on numerous occasions on different projects, and I have a complete level of confidence in their abilities to complete water quality projects. They've been great to work with in the past. So with respect to the vetting criteria, Lisa Wallace is here. She's going to be speaking more to how they select projects, but we would take their criterion, and then we would develop an agreement that overlays criteria established by the SEP policy, criteria established by the State Revolving Fund, and any other criteria that the board identifies as appropriate. And we would overlay those criteria in the development of a pilot project agreement. In order to fund this project, we would use monies that are remaining in the North Star Mountain Properties Settlement Fund. There will be slightly less than $700,000 left in that fund at the end of this year once we finish up the activities that are occurring this season. So the board could choose to use any portion of that fund as a seed money, if you will, to get this pilot project off the ground and running. And then there's a few projects that the Watershed Council has identified as projects that may be appropriate for consideration for a pilot project purpose. These are all projects that are smaller in funding amounts, except one of them. The projects that completed in a shorter time frame. So for the purpose of a pilot project, you know, they are probably more appropriate. So it gives us quicker feedback on how this process is working. And Lisa Walls will be speaking more to how these projects were developed and what they entail. But the goals of the pilot project would be to, working through that process, would be to identify the attributes that we're looking for in a partner organization, and to refine the project evaluation criteria. You know, again, the Watershed Council has their criteria, and we want to overlay certain criteria over that. But we want to see what other criteria may be appropriate or what criteria works, doesn't work, so on and so forth. And once we get that information feedback, then we would incorporate that into the development of templates that we could then use region-wide for other organizations and, of course, be able to modify those templates on a geographic basis as needed. So I would like to turn it over to Lisa Wallace right now, who is the executive director for the Hudson River Watershed Council. And
excuse me, but might I suggest that we do two separate things here? One is to consider the recommendations of the SEP committee with respect to the sort of broad policy considerations which would then allow us, if we decided that we wanted to pursue those, would then allow us to enter into an agreement to do a pilot project. And depending on the outcome of that, then we can either discuss working with the Truckee River folks as a pilot project or in some other context. I'm concerned that the steps go in logical order, that the idea of a pilot project doesn't drive the broad policy for SEPs, but rather fits into a broad policy that we have considered or talked about, if that's agreeable. If that's agreeable
I agree
with the board and also with the staff.
Very logical.
So I might flip to this slide. These are some discussion points that I put up with respect to some feedback that we would like from the board in your discussion with respect to various recommendations from the subcommittee. So I'll leave it to your discussion at this point.
Thank you. What I would suggest that we do is there's sort of this idea of, do we like this conceptually, broadly? If so, what are the next things we need to do in terms of developing agreements, templates, criteria, etc.? Talk about that, and then thirdly, wherever that takes us. So sort of in the broad, looking at the broad context of the committee report. Mr. Jardine, do you have any thoughts?
Yes, I think we're going in the right direction. I think the subcommittee has done a very good job, and I like to I like the idea of shovel-ready projects, you know, on the ground. I think we need to look at on geographic nexus to consider IRWM boundaries, using those as a template. I do like the idea of escrow accounts and establishing partnerships. And I do support the doing a pilot project with TRWC. Those are my comments.
Mr. Sandell?
I think there have been a lot of projects over the years that I've been part of or observed, and term, we should drop the term shovel-ready. They are rarely filed. You just say practical construction projects or something, but it's a buzzword that doesn't fit the way reality is going to present itself. But I agree that doing practical projects on the ground are preferable when we have the choice between that and, say, a study, something more abstract. Sometimes studies and gathering of technical data is exactly what's needed, but for set projects especially, I think we all feel more satisfied when we are involved with something that results in a pipe on the ground or a pond or something that we can see. Expanding the boundaries to watershed or possibly beyond the watershed, the actual watershed, depending on circumstance, seems sensible. I think the broader the interpretation we make of those issues, the more flexible we can be in how we apply money. Sometimes we get a great deal of money in a settlement and perhaps don't really have a way of applying it locally where the event took place that the penalty was collected for. So going wider seems like a good idea. The pilot project with the Truckee River Water Council, of course, we have a history with them. It's all been good. There may be other groups that would like to compete to do a pilot project with us in addition to, perhaps. But certainly I support an effort with them. It's one of our first. And, of course, the whole idea of the escrow accounts and of taking less of staff time, once we get that up and rolling, it's going to take probably more staff time for a little bit. But once we get that going, assuming that the state has no problem with the whole concept, seems like it could be very effective.
Ms. Cox?
I truly believe this is an excellent program, bringing some of that money, keeping some of that money in the local communities to further projects. I would be reluctant to limit what the SEP money is used for, whether it's all shovel-ready or studies, because I think the needs are so diverse given the situations. I know in this region, SEP money has been approved for a salt loading study, which will benefit the entire region. It's not a physical project, but it's something that will lay the foundation for any future projects for this area. I just really applaud the work of the committee and staff developing this idea to this level. Thank you.
Dr. Horn.
Mr. Dice,
I'm varying the order. I don't want anybody to get too comfortable.
I was all ready.
Well, I think just to respond to Ms. Cox's comments, I think the thinking in the group, at least how I understood it, was when there already is a large-scale plan in place, such as a watershed study or a salt nutrient management plan, and individual projects have been prioritized and identified within that area, that in that case the preference would be for on-the-ground projects that directly benefit water quality in some way. But when those broader geographic watershed plans and salt nutrient management plans are not already in place, then the better use of the money might be to fund those kinds of studies. But the idea was when the larger plan is in place, then a study may not be the best use of the money. Mm-hmm. Because there are on-the-ground projects in the pipeline that may directly benefit water quality. So that was kind of, at least how I understood our discussion in the subcommittee, was what we were thinking. The only question I had was about the funding flexibility. So, if, for example, the basic question is, and this is for maybe Chris or I don't know who, one of you people. does if money went into a fund, would it have to be expended in that same fiscal or calendar year, or, I mean, if there was some reason that this endowment fund would prefer to hold on to that money until they got more funds or something, that they could do that as well.
So, again, this is Chris Kerrigan from the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement. The answer to that is, you know, it depends. So, I was going to respond to that question or address it in the context of one of the slides that Lisa was going to present. And I'll do it now, and then when she presents the slides, it should gel for you. But say you wanted to fund some money to the Martis Creek Watershed Restoration Project. And that's the one that Eric had pause about, because it's a big ticket item. It's about $500,000 to finish the project, although there is $1.2 million already committed towards this big old project. So in that case, if there's a milestone that we could identify in there that could, it's as part of the project, that could be funded with, say, $100,000 or even $50,000, we could put that towards that milestone. Right, so in a project where we've already got that money, we could discreetly carve out a function, describe it, and fund that function. It doesn't have to be the whole project, and they could use the money for that. In the context that you described, where it's kind of the upfront money, we could use it for the beginning component or the first phase of a project, as long as we could establish that that first phase had its own benefit. It was a necessary step, in other words, to complete the second phase or third phase. Mm-hmm. We can't park money in accounts and wait for something to happen.
Okay.
So there's a real difference there. But I'm not sure we'll ever really face that problem or need to address something in that way, because generally speaking, when you address folks, and we've heard sort of the descriptions here of where things are, let's say you needed a salt and nutrient management plan. You could fund that up front, or try to get a component of that funded with a specific amount of money. So the idea with the Truckee, with Lisa's group, the Watershed Council, is that for them we can fund things on the front end where they may already have potentially some funding in place that they could move towards the back end of the project. In other words, they could move our money up front for a component of the project and then leave the back end of it unfunded until they get the last. So, for example, they're 450 short, I think, or 500 short on this Martis Creek project. So I'm just using these examples to address your question. If there was a discharge or an ACL action, and it was resolved, and a discharger had $100,000 to put towards that project, it could go towards things that are already being accomplished on the project, and then there would still be an open ended need at the end for the remaining $400,000. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. And then the second question I have is in the settlement discussions, and you're talking to a discharger about the potential for a SEP, and you're talking about, some third-party organization that has some projects, what will come out of the settlement discussions is the SEP money will go towards this specific project or these specific projects, or is the... what comes out of the settlement is the money will go into an endowment fund more generally?
It has to be the former.
Okay.
Because remember, the whole idea here is the discharger, it's a suspended liability until the project is completed,
okay,
or the component of the project is completed. So if we look at the work plan, and there are four distinct project or components of the work plan, we can say in this agreement, the discharger will fund the second component of this project, and when the second component is completed, we'll let them go.
Okay.
Right? So that's the way the mechanics have to work to be consistent with the policy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Dias.
Yes, please. First item, yes, I would definitely prefer SEPs with the water quality connectivity. Second bullet,
thank you, Mr. Sandell. helping us to eliminate the buzzword shovel-ready. I'll prefer practical, tangible construction projects. I generally prefer physical projects, but there are cases where studies are beneficial, so I'd look at that on a case-by-case basis. I'm going to skip over geographic nexus for a minute. The next one's, yes, I support SEP escrow accounts and partnerships. The last one, yes, I would support a pilot project with the Tahoe River Watershed Council if it met all of our other criteria. I trust the council. We do have a history of completing successful projects with them. However, geographic nexus. I'm strongly opposed to locating a SEP outside a watershed boundary. Dr. Horn and I were just looking at the IRWM boundaries for Inyo Mono, and that's 300 miles long. So there's a danger that a SEP could be located 300 miles from where a violation occurred. I believe that a SEP should benefit the same water body that was damaged by the violation. So I don't want to change that. I'd like to keep it in the same watershed boundary. I think it should be as close as possible to where the harm occurred. And those are my comments. Thank you.
Can I ask Mr. Dias a question?
Of course.
Okay. So if there was a situation where there was a discharge to a small surface water within a larger watershed, and the water quality benefit to the projects that were that meet our criteria in that small surface water area, if the water quality benefit there was relatively small, but within the larger watershed there was another project, still the same watershed, but not the directly affected water body, where the water quality benefit would be much greater, would you still prefer it to be closer to the smaller watershed?
Not necessarily. I would prefer to accomplish the best water quality benefit.
Okay.
But in the example that Eric brought up, in that if a violation occurred in the Tahoe Basin, allowing an expansion to the IRWM boundary would allow that SEP money to be spent on a SEP, say, in Alpine County. However, it would also allow the reverse to occur. It would allow a violation that occurred in Alpine County to fund a SEP in Tahoe, and there might be temptation to do that.
So this is something in each settlement agreement, because this is part of a discrete action, there would need to be a finding in there about the SEP meeting the criteria. And so if the situation came up, even one that might be described more beautifully than the hypothetical that Dr. Horn provided, the board would still have to make a finding that the SEP is the one that they want. And so the idea here is you will have some flexibility with geographic limitations, but you don't have to exercise that. And so it's a matter of staff direction. If staff felt strongly that you got a greater benefit outside the basin, that would be a recommendation. There would be a recommended finding, but the board would always have the opportunity to discuss that finding when the settlement agreement was proposed.
Anything further? Well, I'm really pleased with the results of the subcommittee's work. It's exciting to create opportunities, and hopefully this will avoid the board being in the position of what the hell is this, as a reaction to a proposed resolution. I'm going to ask for some advice from council in terms of how we proceed at this point, since I'm sensing a consensus among the board, and I'm sensing that we're proceeding in the direction of coming to a point where we're going to enter into an agreement with the Truckee River Water Council to do the pilot project, I want to make sure we do things in the right order and we get the proper board authorizations as we go along. So I don't know if I have two possible scenarios that I can see here. One would be that the board expresses its comfort with the proposed recommendations from the subcommittee, that the board suggests to the subcommittee that it continue to explore a couple of questions. One is, what would an agreement look like with a partner? Two is, what are the criteria that the board is going to use or ask that the partners use to rank and describe projects, and then the board itself would use ultimately to approve those projects. Three, I think we have to at some point request authorization from the state board for these accounts, but we don't have to do that, am I correct, Chris, for the proposed pilot?
If the board wants to use the North Star settlement funds to fund some of the projects that you'll hear about, I think you could do that by resolution, which of course would have to be noticed, but you could do that, right, without going to the state board to establish a special account, as long as you were, because of the way that money has already been set aside, and we don't have the typical obligations that we would have with the discharger. That action or that money was created before the policies were adopted. So if the board wanted to fund some projects with that money, the answer is no. You don't have to go to the state board. You would just have to adopt it by resolution, and I'll let Kim address the niceties about resolutions and the formalities on that level. If the board wanted to then consider putting money in the future for future ACL actions into projects that the council is working on, then I would have to go, or we would go to the state board and request that they authorize the deposit of funds into that account. And, I'd be happy to go with Patty or whoever. If the board authorizes me to go and do that, my sense is that probably would also need to be furthered by way of a resolution.
And that would be the case going into the future if we had a settlement agreement in another area, say in Yomono, we would need to ask you to take to the state board a request to establish the account at that time, but we don't have to do that until there's an actual event.
Right. And it doesn't have to be me. I'm just saying that I'd be more than happy. I'd be more than happy to do that. It could be you or whoever you like.
But I could do it.
But I think Patty and I should do it. That would be my recommendation. And then, in the future, if there's an entity that you're looking at going, we want to fund this entity's efforts to develop a salt and nutrient management plan and or implement projects pursuant to that plan or whatever it is, then we would use our experience with this first approach to go to the board again and try to establish another account that would be for the benefit of that watershed and through that entity.
Okay. So I'm wondering if the course of action that we could take would be to say, to charge the committee and staff to bring back to us a package that would implement what we're discussing here through a board resolution. And then the notice and all those other things could be accomplished that way. We really would not be taking any formal action of any kind today.
That's correct. We
Does
don't
have sense?
Anything
right, we have nothing
today. But I guess a couple things to think about are, you know, we've talked about the general concept, and it sounds like everyone's interested in the general concept of moving forward with this type of project. So we are going to hear from the council, and we'll talk about that pilot project and maybe bring back a resolution that would propose putting that North Star money towards those projects. And whether or not we're going to be identifying specific projects or having staff identify, you know, as part of that resolution, specific projects, you know, maybe something to consider. But I think that there's probably a second step that would be sort of more general, and maybe this is something that you charge the subcommittee with in terms of developing these additional documents that may be a template of an agreement and some of the things that you identified, Chair, including what sort of criteria we're going to request that the other entities use in terms of developing the list for us. And it seems to me that these would have to be maybe ongoing outreach with our staff to those other entities. I'm not sure how the timing will work in terms of, you know, we have a SEP, and then do we, you know, go try to make those agreements at that time, or maybe we should, you know, be directing the subcommittee or staff to be developing those relationships now.
Well, I think in terms of accomplishing what we're sort of focused on, what I would suggest, if this is possible, would be to come back to the board with a package that included a SEP policy that was that comported with the recommendations of the committee, that included an agreement or a proposed template for agreement, and at least some general criteria that would be used to evaluate what I think would then be a subsequent, like seconds later, request to approve the pilot project. Because I think they're two separate actions, at least in my mind. And so one, the second requires approval of the first. So in order to approve the pilot project, we have to approve the mechanism that allows the pilot project to go forward. So what I think I'd like to do then is to hear from Ms. Wallace and then charge the committee and staff with bringing that kind of resolution to the board at some subsequent meeting.
Maybe January.
Yeah, I'm thinking that we probably can't do it with notice and everything else and the fact that we don't have a template in our back pocket. So that sounds fine then. Is that agreeable with?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Wallace, please. Sorry to put you on hold.
Thank you very much for having me to speak for the Truckee River Watershed Council. And I just want to say I completely appreciate the efforts for, you know, correct or appropriate process, establishing the program and then establishing a pilot program. I completely and fully understand that. And we all know there have been a few attempts to have SEPs run more effectively and efficiently, and, taking these appropriate steps, I think, greatly helps us. So, and also as a taxpayer, I have to say I really appreciate it, in addition to potentially being able to help deploy some of the SEP funds. So, again, I'm Lisa Wallace. I'm the Executive Director of the Truckee River Watershed Council, and I'm happy to be here today. And wow, look at that, I really can use technology. So I work for the Watershed Council. I was the first paid staff person. The organization was founded as a nonprofit in 1996, and the first paid staff position was mine in 2001. So for the first 5 years, the organization worked as an all-volunteer organization. And the initial successes in bringing the community together to protect, enhance, and restore the Truckee River watershed, those initial successes gave the confidence to that volunteer board to want to take on larger scale projects. And I'll describe some of the evolution of our organization. And I think one of the key purposes for me this morning is to let you know about our organization, but also to convey to you how I think the Watershed Council is an organization that, in the context of SEPs, can reduce the risk for the discharger in wanting to select the support of a SEC project. We understand that they potentially have some risk. If, for example, my organization receives the funds but doesn't deliver on the project, no, that's a risk for the discharger. We also, I think, are a good candidate for reducing the risk for the water board, for the Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board. Because, again, if a SEP project is funded and isn't carried through, now you're back to the position where the staff is, again, spending time on it, the discharger is dissatisfied, et cetera. And then a recipient, in this case, my organization, but there will be other recipients of SEP funds, also needs the risk reduced. Is that money actually going to be available? When is it going to be available? If I have a project phase that's keyed to that funding, I need to make sure I'm going to get that funding because the phase is dependent on it. So all three entities need the risk reduced, and I hope today that what I talk about with you can show the Watershed Council and the pilot project is able to reduce those risks. Just a little bit about the Truckee River. Actually, I want to go back here and say the map shows, obviously, the Truckee River watershed. In the lower right-hand corner of the map is Lake Tahoe. The Truckee River is the only outlet of Lake Tahoe, the main stem of the Truckee. And my organization follows that course of the Truckee River to the California-Nevada state line, that we focus on the main stem of the Truckee and the 25 major tributaries that flow into the Truckee River. And I'll show you a tributary map in just a minute, a little bit more about the watershed. So while our watershed, the Truckee River watershed, is beautiful, it's not healthy and it's not pristine, hence the need for getting practical construction projects implemented. We have four TMDLs, the Truckee River and Donner Lake, Squaw Creek and Bronco Creek. I know you get to hear a lot about Squaw Creek, but there are three other TMDLs. Since the 1850s, there's a, like many places in the western United States and in the Lahontan region, there's a very intensive decade and a half long history of land use with clear cuts and timber harvesting, grazing. We also have both the fortune and the detriment of the Intercontinental Railroad coming through our watershed. Three highways, seven dams. A lot of people don't realize that Tahoe is dammed and six of our tributaries are dam controlled. Creates some benefit for the users of those waters, but a lot of impact both upstream and downstream of the dams. Gravel mining. In our 435 square miles, we have 10 golf course and ski resorts. Big impact from that type of recreation use. Also some benefit. And we're in the midst, ironically, given where the rest of the country is, we're in the midst of a building boom. It's the strangest thing. Development applications to the town of Truckee, Placer County, and Nevada County are double what they were last year. And that's for individual residences, but also for commercial and large-scale development. So we're really starting to see the arc coming into our watershed. Threats, fire, and climate change are what we're really seeing at the moment. Some current land use, but we have to acknowledge that current regulatory framework addresses a lot of the potential threats from new land use. And the impacts are to our water quality, our fishery. Fishery's not healthy here. To our wildlife. And then, of course, there's the secondary impact to our local economy if we're not addressing the threats. That context is why the Truckee River Watershed Council was formed in 1996. We started off at about $20,000 a year in 1996 to produce a community-based river restoration day called Truckee River Day. About 500 volunteers come out every year. In just 3 weeks, we have the 18th annual Truckee River Day. 500 people will come out and work on 10 restoration projects scattered throughout the whole watershed. I mentioned that in 2001, I was hired, and we started to grow the organization to take on larger scale restoration projects. And by 2005, our annual run rate was about $400,000 a year. And last year, we did $1.2 million, implementing five large scale restoration projects, as well as a number of prevention projects. We want to keep the problems that are existing today from getting worse, in addition to fixing the legacy projects. We have five full-time equivalent staff, 11 board members. Nonprofit organizations are required to have a governing board, and we have a very solid full complement board right now. 40 stakeholders that are comprised of agencies, businesses, and nonprofits. And I made a little asterisk on the nonprofit here to let you know that we are one of the founding members, the Watershed Council, along with a number of other organizations, of the Tahoe-Sierra IRWM group. So we started with that IRWM group actually in 2004 to be able to get ready for the initial funding streams that started in 2005. And we operate with 5 advisory committees or stakeholder committees. So how do we plan our work? How do we figure out what needs to get done? We worked with UC Davis Information Center for the Environment, also sometimes called the John Muir Institute. And we received a grant from the Lahontan Water Board in this same period to put together a coordinated watershed management strategy. And the map up here breaks out, so based on the development of the coordinated watershed management strategy, the map is one of the outputs. It breaks out for us the 25 major tributaries in the Truckee River watershed and ranks them in priority importance. The red areas are the highest, and the brighter green colors are the lowest priority. And our goal is over the next decade to get substantially more of that map green, get it out of the red and orange areas. That would let us know that we're addressing that set of legacy and current land use issues that I talked about in the previous slide. So out of the coordinated watershed management strategy, which, by the way, we're updating this year, we'll have a completed update in December of that. Out of that watershed strategy, the Watershed Council led a series of sub-basin assessments. So Coldstream Canyon, Dry Creek, Gray Creek, Johnson Canyon, Martis Watershed, which becomes relevant in just a couple more minutes for us, the Little Truckee River. Since 2002, when we completed the watershed strategy, we've completed this set of sub-basin assessments. That becomes important when I show you our project list. The projects come out of the watershed assessments. Our stakeholders have also started leading a series of assessments. So the Forest Service, Army Corps of Engineers, state parks, the town of Truckee, even our local public utility district are doing assessments based on water quality as well as their needs for smaller areas in the watershed. It's been really gratifying to coordinate the efforts of, you know, we're not all perfectly coordinated, as you know, it just isn't really possible, but to gain an overall set of direction and momentum with the 40-plus stakeholders somehow involved in water quality, that's been very gratifying over the last decade. So we have a list. We literally have a project list that right now has about 660 restoration projects on it. And how do we get to the list? The assessments and the studies that I mentioned in the previous slide are what generate the 60 projects that are on the list. We have a projects and assessments committee. It's one of the 5 advisory committees that I mentioned. They meet 4 times a year. And one of the things that they do is check in on the list and do peer review of projects that are being implemented. So projects that were on the list that have moved into the practical construction phase, there's a peer review of those projects. For a project to get on the list, it's screened with 21 criteria. I'm not going to really describe the criteria, but in the report that you have there, the 21 criteria are listed in here, and if it's appropriate in the future, we can really drill down into those with you. But they cover, as you can imagine, soundness, readiness, and funding, permitting. So there's a set of science or technical screening that happens, as well as a project readiness set of criteria for screening. The list is reviewed by the Projects and Assessments Committee every 2 years. My staff prepares the list and manages the list, but it's reviewed by the Projects and Assessments Committee every other year. I put on here that it's disappointingly stable. That's why we only need to review it every other year. Restoration projects have a long life cycle to go from the time they're identified in an assessment and to go through the feasibility studies, the design studies, the permitting, the implementation, and the post-project monitoring. That's often 6 or 7 years for that whole project life cycle to complete. So the list stays surprisingly stable. What we do now is we break a given project into four phases: design, permitting, construction, and monitoring, so that even though it's staying on the list, we can see its progress through the progression. So we've done the overall water strategy. Then we do assessments on a sub-basin. The assessments identify projects. That's one source of projects on the list. Our stakeholders, for example, the Forest Service does assessments, which leads projects. That gets another set of projects on the list. So how do projects get selected for funding? So we look again at the type of the project: water quality, water supply, wildlife, fishery, and forest health. They're literally, a project is slotted into one category. We look at the phase, we look at the status, and then we look at the funding requirements. Different funders have different requirements. There are no two funders that have the same set of requirements. They have different types of goals. It might be water quality, it might be water supply, habitat, upland, wetland. Amounts, are they fund? Is it a 5K funding cycle? Is it a 2 million funding cycle? Some of the older water bonds would fund projects up to $2 million. Is it a one-year funding cycle? Will the funding be allowed to go multi-year, et cetera, et cetera? There's a lot of different criteria in funding. So we take the projects that are on the list, and we look at them against the funding criteria, and the combination of the list plus the funding equals what gets selected. So for us, for me to come to you and say, I have a project list with 60 projects on it, and here's the priority 1 to 60, that's disingenuous. If a project has made it through those 21 criteria and a review in the Projects and Assessments Committee, it's work that we want to get done in the next decade or so. And then specifically, how does the Middle Martis Creek Watershed Restoration Project get selected? It's a combination of where it is in its funding status, or excuse me, where it is in its project status, and what are the funding criteria. So maybe I'll just stop at this point and ask if you have any questions, and then I'll drop down into one specific idea for the potential SEP pilot. Nope? Great. So we looking at our project list, looking at what we understood about the source of the current SEP, I know they're not really SEP funds, they're settlement funds from North Star. Looking at what we understood about that funding criteria and what was on our project list, we suggested to the subcommittee three projects that could fit for a pilot. One is the Middle Martis Restoration Project, and the descriptions of the projects, again, are in your report, and I'm happy to talk about the specifics of the projects, but I recognize that may not be the appropriate level of detail today, but if you want me to describe them, I will, but at the moment, I'm just going to focus on the numbers. The total project budget is $1.5 million, as Chris said. We have committed funding of just over $1 million. And to close the gap, we need about $450,000. What does closing the gap mean? It means that we could move into full construction in 2014. If we received partial funding, and again, I'm referencing a scenario that Chris laid out for a given discharger. If a discharger had, for example, $150,000 and they liked the Middle Martis project, it turns out in the case of the Middle Martis project, we can phase construction. We can break construction into two phases. So the gap here in my very simplified chart shows that we need to close the gap about $450,000 for construction. If we were partially funded at about $150,000, $175,000, we could complete phase one of construction in 2014, and then in 2015, and then we would be working to raise the rest of the funding, which I feel very optimistic about because it's an incredible project, and we would complete construction in a second phase in 2015. Elizabethtown is also in the Martis watershed. It's actually fairly close in this case to the violation site. In this case, we need about $95,000 to complete construction. And again, it could be phased. Coincidentally, The Middle Martis Project and Elizabethtown can be broken into two phases of construction, not three is what I'm really trying to say. They can be broken into two phases. And Dry Creek Restoration, some of you may also, that are more familiar with the Truckee River watershed, may know Dry Creek as Russell Valley. Again, a very open, broad meadow system, heavily impacted by grazing. And we could move into construction again in 2014 if we can close that funding gap. So these are three projects that we would propose. If the SEP pilot project were funded at roughly $700,000, this is how we would recommend deploying the funds. We, of course, could review the whole project list with the subcommittee and propose other projects. The subcommittee asked me to make kind of three levels of recommendations for different amounts of funding the pilot, $250,000, $500,000, and $750,000. So I'm not going to go into this, but depending on the amount that's put in the pilot project budget, this would be how we would recommend splitting it, or some ideas. You know, there's various things that can happen, but some ideas. And then I just want to close telling you about one project that, not through SEP funds, but through other funds that the Water Board, your staff at the Water Board, has helped us implement. So Carrazzo Meadows, we started on this project in about 2007. You all will remember at the very end of 2008, all bond funds were suspended for what at the time, at the end of 2008, was an unknown period. And it put this project on hold. We had completed design, and we were ready to go into construction in 2009. You know, very severe meadow and stream impacts. And I really would like to give a lot of credit to Cindy Wise and the people that she worked with at the Water Board. And also with the state. I know the State Water Resources Control Board staff were also very instrumental. They helped us fund our, what was proposition or state-funded money, in, somehow into American Investment and Recovery Act funding that was then later, when the bond funds were turned on, supplemented in some way with some of the water bond money. And we were actually able to implement the Carrazzo Meadows Restoration Project, taking down-cut, channelized streams, putting back in their remnant channels, rewatering 400 acres of meadow, 400 acres of meadow. The water table has lifted on average 2.5 feet. We've already seen recovery of the fish populations. It's amazing, recovering the fish. I cross my fingers on that. It's only 4 years since we implemented this phase of restoration. And now we're seeing late in the season, and you can see back here, the meadow's dried out here. It's appropriate for that part of the meadow to be dry, by the way. It's at a higher elevation. But that lets us know that it's later in the season. We're looking at a photo that's in September, but this part of the meadow is still watered. And that's because the remnant channels in that part of the meadow are still holding the water. And that's directly as a result of the restoration project. So this is the kind of scale of project that we can do when we have the funds. And it's a scale of the work that we aspire to be able to do in the Truckee River watershed to address those legacy and current land use impacts that we're seeing. And that's all I have. If you've got questions, I'm happy to answer them. Or
are there any questions? Thank you very much. What I would propose to do then is to give some direction to staff and to the extent that they feel the committee can be helpful, the committee. And so jump in here if I'm saying something that doesn't make any sense or is completely stupid or any of the other things I do on occasion. But I think what I would like to ask staff to do is to bring back a package that would address one, overall STEP policy, which reflects the committee report. Two, criteria describing partnership organizations. Three, proposed agreement with a partner, which would also include some description of fiscal processes. Four, potential project criteria or evaluation criteria for use by the partner and by the board in approving any project. And five, the necessary documents to enable us and a recommendation from the menu that we've been presented this morning that would enable us to go forward with a pilot project with the Truckee River Watershed Council. So I think that that would be a package of at least two, perhaps more, board resolutions, and then a non-board resolution, but more recommendation that was suggested by Ms. Niemeyer is suggestions regarding potential outreach into the other watershed areas within the region. So if that makes sense, that would be what I would hope we could next accomplish. And I thank everybody for a lot of hard work, but this is really exciting.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Just one quick observation on the board discussion when we talk about geographic nexus and using IRWM boundaries and consideration Alpine County. Even though we're not within the Lake Tahoe Basin watershed, we are impacted, Alpine County is, by receiving waters from South Tahoe Beauty and Indian Creek Reservoir is, which was used for secondary effluent, is impacted. It is a 303D listed impaired watershed. So we are Alpine County. There is some nexus with the Tahoe Basin. And the Upper Truckee River does start within Alpine County. So there's, I just wanted to make those quiet observations. Some flexibility. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Well, I do. Everybody else does. Which is, so responding to your point, Board Member Jardine, it's useful to remember that there are two ways you can make a nexus on a project.
Yeah.
There's geographic and there's programmatic. And I don't know if it'd be worth taking a couple minutes maybe to clarify how programmatic nexus works. I'm not very clear on it myself, but my simplistic understanding of it is that if there was a discharge that involved sediment, that the SET project could be a sediment reduction related project that would not necessarily have to have a geographic nexus because it would have a programmatic nexus. Is that correct?
Yeah, the way I would look at that is very, very close to that, but also through the lens of beneficial uses. So if it had the same kind of impact on beneficial uses that the SEP was designed to ameliorate, then I would look at that as a programmatic nexus. So even a little broader than the way you described it.
Okay, so...
So a sediment... so a 401 violation...
I don't know what that is.
401 is dredge and fill for, take on wetlands or waters of the U.S. A 401 type violation or a stormwater violation where it was a discharge of sediments... Either of those could go to a restoration project involving wetlands or a sediment removal type of project.
Or cold water fishery habitat or...
Absolutely, because it's the same kind of impact. Those things are causing an impact to that beneficial use. And so I always try to come back to beneficial uses when looking at how to relate things. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a way to go at it programmatically.
Thank you.
Thank you. Also, I have a request... Our speaker card from Mr. Gobbler.
He's been sitting very patiently.
He has.
Yeah, thank you very much, Tim Gobbler from Mojave Wateries.
Sorry.
No problem. Everyone winds up pronouncing it that way. So I just wanted to comment on the Supplemental Environmental Project Program. We really appreciate that the regional board is looking at refining the SEP program. We think that it does have a tremendous benefit to the local areas, and we think that it's, when penalty monies are incurred, that if they can be used in a SEP program, that's always a benefit because the money is returning to the region where they came from. As the regional board knows, we are making use of SEP monies for a salt nutrient management plan for the Mojave region. So we're looking forward to the outcome of that. And I'd also like to just, with the recommendation of looking at integrated regional water management plans, I'd really like to encourage the regional board to look at those in identifying potential SEP programs. Those are stakeholder-driven water management plans that virtually look at every aspect of water management in a region, including water quality, and they contain a list of prioritized projects that were prioritized by the stakeholders. So from Mojave Water Agency's perspective, we really think the regional board, when it's applicable, should look at those when trying to identify SEPs. The Mojave IRWM plan is we're in the process of updating that right now, and that will be completed in the first half of 2014. And I'd also like to say that Mojave Water Agency would be very interested in assisting the board in refining their SEP program, and also in potentially partnering with the regional board in implementing SEP projects, like what we're doing with the salt nutrient management plan. So that's the only comments I have, unless there's any questions.
Are there any questions?
No.
Thank you. We appreciate the opportunity to work with you.
All right, thank you. And I also have a letter from my general manager.
Thank you.
I'd like to submit.
Thank you very much for your participation these last 2 days. We do have closed session. And really appreciate your being with us.